Tenth Fleet had pretty good success, about 80% of what they set out to do, but I don't think it would have ever gotten off the ground if it wasn't for this place and the people who work there. This is Bletchley Park in the UK. It's about a 45-minute ride north of London. As Mitch said, last fall I organized, or he was mentioning, I organized a small group of friends who were also retired U.S. Navy cryptologists to visit Bletchley Park as a group. Music is supposed to be there. Well, I'll spoil the secret. That's the Elgar's Enigma Variations, which was written in commemoration of breaking the code at Bletchley Park, which you've probably heard so much about. I'd been there before, but I couldn't think of a better place to be with a better group of people. On the day of the Bletchley Park Veterans Reunion, there were enactors, displays, exhibits, as well as a memorial service to honor the veterans. The whole place was set up just as it was during World War II. Please keep in mind that most of the bomb, that's the machine you've probably heard about that Alan Turing built to break the Enigma code, the research and development of that and the building was done pretty much before the war even started. There were about 200 of them built. They were manufactured and were in various parts of the UK as well as Bletchley Park. Bletchley Park was mostly a German communications deciphering factory, running 24 hours a day and staffed by up to 10,000 people who were dedicated to their task as well as keeping their activities totally secret. So much so that many of their families, spouses, and as well as parents and children never knew what they were doing during the war. None of them ever revealed anything to anyone until just a few years ago. Compare that to what's going on now in our own government. I think there's more leaks coming out of the White House than there are across the street in Penn Station's men's rooms. Well, we'll get to some of the activities there that was going on during that great reunion. Here we are, Bletchley. This is the program they had for the veterans. This was, I think, the 8th of September last year. This was the plan, sort of their plan of the day of what they had lined up for the veterans. We were greeted at the gate by Winston himself. He heard that they're having a former Navy cryptological officer visiting, so he came out to greet me. I asked him how he knew we were going to be there. He said he couldn't tell me. These are some of the exhibits that were around Bletchley. That 6x looks like it just came out of the factory. It's been restored perfectly. I don't know where they got it. They probably comshored it after the war. They're trying to get me to join the French Foreign Legion. These guys, they came walking up the street to me and saluted. And I said, oh, we got some Americans here. Nope, reenactors. I think my wife and I were the only Americans in the whole place. Everybody you're going to see are Brits. And they did a fantastic job. Civilians were there in the 40s, civilian attires. There's some guy, I think he's a reporter. Brits, notice the ladies are dressed as they were back during the war. You notice the First Louis there? Well, she's a Brit, just part of the reenactors. Look at this guy. I don't think Hollywood could come up with something like that. He looks like he just got out of his B-17 after a bombing run on Bremen. But he's a Brit. You know, he talked funny and everything. Here's another one, another British guy being interviewed by the press. They're all Brits. I don't know what the joke is. Winston said something about me trying to take their picture or something, but it must have been funny. They're all laughing. My wife thinks that that was Rosie the Riveter. Now, here's a, got any hams here? This is one group of dedicated hams. They rebuild the wartime and previous radio equipment, get it all working better than new. But they also had the vans, the trucks, the mobile antennas. When I first walked up to this thing, I said, oh, my God, is it field day? No, it couldn't be. But they were demonstrating their gear. Everything is working probably better than when it was built, including the vans. I mean, the engines and everything are perfect. They're very serious about what they do. Here they have some ham shacks set up outside. Here's some more of the equipment. You may recognize, if you're a ham, you may recognize Arc 5s here. I used to have one of them years ago. And this receiver, this is the receiver of choice that they used at Bletchley and all the outstations for receiving the German comms. The National HRO, it's a 2 to 30 megahertz receiver, but it's not band switching. If you change bands, you have to take this little tray of coils out and plug another tray in. And I think it came with about four or five trays to cover the whole band. And they had everything, you know, pre-war. They have a Churchill memorabilia museum. Everything Churchill. It's about the size of a gymnasium. It's huge. And here my wife is sitting in Churchill's own chair, and she's holding a box of cigars that fits in this little space under his chair. And they are good Havana cigars. She wanted to smoke one, but they just didn't have enough of them. But that's his own chair. Jack Barra, he's the owner. And this is the everything on display. Now, the World War II Bletchley veterans, just before we were there, a few weeks before we were there, there was another lady that gave a terrific speech commemorating the World War II, I hate to say the word, hackers. She gave a terrific speech. As a cryptologist, I can certainly appreciate it. See if you recognize her.
In August 1939, 200 people arrived at Bletchley Park. By the end of 1944, there were 10,000. We gather here to commemorate the work of that remarkable group of people. It is impossible to overstate
that's the bomb
deep
working.
Sense of admiration, gratitude, and national debt that we owe to all those men, and especially women. They were called to this place in the greatest secrecy, so much so that some of their families will never know the full extent of their contribution. As they set about on a seemingly impossible mission, a massive challenge in the field of cryptanalysis, for the first time pitting technology against technology. And so these huts and buildings became the center of a worldwide web of intelligence communications, spanning the Commonwealth and further afield. This was the place of geniuses such as Alan Turing. But these wonderfully clever mathematicians, language graduates, and engineers were complemented by people with different sets of skills, harnessing that brilliance through methodical, unglamorous, hard slog. Thus, the secret of Bletchley's success was that it became a home to all the talents. We can be proud of the legacy of Bletchley, proud of that Colossus was the first computer, and that the British people, supported by our friends and allies, rose to the challenge. At heart, we have always been a nation of problem solvers. This natural aptitude was taken to new heights by the emergency of war, showing that necessity is indeed the mother of invention, and that battles can be won and many lives saved by using brain power as well as firepower, deliberation as well as force. To those veterans who remain, I offer nothing but praise. You are history shapers, and your example serves as an inspiration to the intelligence community today, as they continue the vital work to protect the people of this country. For your many achievements, I give my heartfelt thanks on behalf of an eternally grateful nation.
I think that was some great speech. The only code we had to break, my wife and I, was how do you identify who were the veterans? Well, it turns out that they were all awarded the Ministry of Defense Bletchley Park Veterans Badge, which this lady is holding. We would call it a pin, but they call it a badge. It's a slightly better picture of it. Also, there's a GCHQ Bletchley Park commemorative badge for service at Bletchley and the outstations. I was able to get a good picture of that. And first gentleman we ran into was Arthur Smith. He decoded the fish methods. He joined on the 13th of May, 44. He had 6 days of training. The fish methods was the system they used to break out Hitler's high command communications, which was done on the old-fashioned teletype, you know, the seven Bordeaux system of teletype. Most of you people probably never saw it because it went out of business years ago. But he's typical of the people they had there. 6 days of training, and he picked up on it himself. And you'll see the system, the Colossus, that was used. It's been restored. Now, here's an interesting lady, Charlotte Webb, not to be confused with the spider. But she was very interesting. I was talking with her. She registered, intercepted traffic, decoded it, analyzed it, and passed the traffic to commanders as well as Churchill himself. In 1945, she was flown to the Pentagon in a Sunderland flying boat, which was a 30-hour flight, where she continued to serve as an analyst. 30-hour flight. That's about what it takes to get from Newark Airport to Washington nowadays. She wrote a book entitled Secret Postings from Bletchley Park to the Pentagon. While we were chatting, she turned the tables on me and caught me by surprise. She asked me how I felt about 9/11. And I wasn't expecting that. I just, off the top of my head, I said, well, it was pretty depressing. A couple more people. Doris Litley, she was a Morse operator at Yorkshire Moors, and the gentleman sitting next to her, he was there when they sunk the Hood. I don't remember, he told me what ship he was on, but I don't remember. I won't try to guess. Some of these Morse operators were unbelievable. They would sit there and copy the German code for 12, 16 hours a day, and they got real good at it. And one of them was saying that they were so afraid to make a single mistake because it would hurt the war effort. Also, they got to be so good at it, they could identify the German operators by their fist. And that alone was valuable intelligence. So they could change call signs, they could change locations, but these gals knew, that's Hans, that's Fritz, you can't fool me. Another lady, Edna Gambit, she worked in Hut 6. She was an intelligence analyst. This was kind of touching. These people were looking for information on, you know, family information. This was this woman's grandmother. All she had, you know, was a picture. She walked around with it to see if anybody could identify her. And as of the time we were speaking with them, they didn't have any luck. Kathleen Mary Stevens, she worked with a Japanese code. And when she said that, I said, oh, yeah, that's right. They were doing a Japanese code over there because the Japs had Enigma machines, too. You wonder where they got them. Well, they're made in Germany. Kathy Gregg Sheargold and Audrey Wynn, they were Wrens. Wrens, they called the Women's Royal Navy folks Wrens, kind of a cute name. They were Enigma and bomb operators, Kathy said she hated working the bomb because it made a lot of noise. You had to walk around it, and it was kind of strenuous. But she loved the dances they had there at Bletchley and some of the airfields. Audrey Wind, if you can remember that name, and you Google her, there are a few talks that she gives on code breaking during the war. It's very interesting. Boy, if you get her here, it would be terrific. More people looking for relatives or friends, looking for friends of their grandma, and they didn't have any luck either. Margaret Eiley, that was her maiden name, Spanton, Women's Auxiliary Air Force, she was a Morris operator. Sometimes they call themselves typists. She said, oh, it was just a typist. You know, she's a typist, all right, with a pair of earphones and one of those HRO receivers. Marjorie Russell Arbery, trained on the Isle of Man, copied code at Harrogate. And she had my wife laughing. She said that she didn't know what all the fuss was about. When she finally got to see an Enigma machine, she said, oh, it's just a tatty old typewriter. Norma Granger Smith, she worked in Hut D. She had the German naval code books in her hands. Talk about history. Pamela McRoberts, she was a Wren, worked in Hut 6. She supplied data at the bomb. Pauline Burrow Lee, she was in administration in Hut 4. And right there, she's pointing to Hut 4 and telling me she's a little mad because they made Hut 4 into the cafeteria. Vera Barton, Hut 8, worked on a Typex machine, and she was dynamite. But before I finish with her, you'll notice in the background, they're running the bomb. They're actually, the thing is cranking away, breaking codes and what have you that they had put into it. One of the things that the gentleman that was running it explained to us, that one of the clues they had for determining the daily code, the Enigma daily code, was they copied the some of the weather ships up in the North Sea, because they'd send out hydro reports every day. And in a preamble of each one of these reports was a couple of words that identified it as a weather report. It may have said Die Wetter heute or something like that. I don't know what it was. But it was always in the same place. It was always encrypted. So there's part of the key right there. And at the end of every one of these messages, you know what, how they signed off, you know, Heil Hitler. So that was another clue. And if I just get off the subject for a moment, when I was stationed in Bremerhaven, Germany, before we moved into base housing, my wife and I rented an apartment on the top floor of a private home a couple towns away from the base. Our landlord and landlady were great people. They treated us like family. And many times we were sitting in the living room with them in the evening, sitting around bullshitting with them, having a beer. And they would spend a lot of time telling us what it was like being in Germany in the 20s, 30s, and during the war. They were in the Hitler Youth, and they weren't ashamed of it. They shouldn't be. But Klaus was in a Kriegsmarine. He was on one of those weather ships in the North Sea until the Brits caught him. And he was a POW. He was a British POW, and then they sold him to the Americans. And he spent a couple of years out in California picking mice. Mice? Picking mice? What the hell are you doing? What do you do with the mice? He says, the Americans, they eat it. He was talking about corn. But I had my ham radio shack set up in the living room of the house. And many times he would come up there and he would just, his eyes were popping out of his head. He loved to watch me operate my ham shack. And all I worked over there was CW, Morse code. And I was just reminded of this a couple of weeks ago. A couple of the guys that took over my apartment when we moved into base housing were also hams. They had their ham gear there. And one of the guys reminded me that Klaus had a very good working knowledge of Morse code. So you put that together with he was gently removed from one of those weather ships up in the North Sea. Of course, the British wanted people, you know, for the intelligence as well as the Enigma machines on those boats. Unfortunately, he's been gone many years. I'd love to grill him on what was going on. Meanwhile, back to Vera. Here she is showing me her Typex Model 23 cipher machine. This was the British version, greatly improved, of the Enigma. It worked sort of like it, except it had more rotors and bigger patch field and everything. She operated this machine. She was taking the raw, or not the raw, the broken out skinny, putting it on this type, this encryption machine, and it went right into Churchill's bunker, which is in London. And if you're ever there, take the time to go through it. It's a tourist trap. It's downtown. It's not far from the Westminster Abbey and that part of town. It's fantastic. But she actually had all of this stuff in her hands, on her watch. I mean, she wasn't the only one, but she was one of them. And she's showing it to me. She was so excited showing it to me and so proud of it. And this is what it looks like up close. The two big round things on either side are print heads. It would print the plain text and the encrypted text. They had a reunion service for the veterans. And this was the complete service. It was very well done, short and to the point. Has anybody ever seen a minister do something this short? I haven't. These are some of the veterans at the memorial, and you notice that one lady there, she has two of the Ministry of Defense Bletchley badges. One was her husband's. So this must have been a tough day for her. And there was a lot of marriages that took place there, too, a lot of dating. Of course, no hanky-panky, of course. None of that was going on there. And here's a group of veterans. There was guys there, too. The younger people are families of veterans. And here's a group of, a bunch of ladies just sitting there yakking. They're enjoying their reunion as much as us Navy guys enjoy our reunions. Of course, they had bagpipers, Sea Cadet Color Guard. As you can see, there's many of them, but we started with around 10,000. This is the picture of the whole group together. I tried to get a head-on shot over to the left, but the BBC was over there, and they kept yelling at me, get out of the way. They must have known I worked for CBS. This is the rock that Churchill stood on when he addressed the crew at Bletchley, where he called them my geese that laid the golden eggs but never cackled. The gentleman, that's my wife on the rock, and the gentleman next to her was our tour guide, a fellow named Dan, who was dynamite. If you ever go to Bletchley and you're going to get a tour, ask for Dan. He's an Irishman, and he just kept one story after another. It was really terrific. There he is talking about the bomb. That's not one of the working ones. This is a Polish memorial for the Polish mathematicians. In the 30s, these guys came up with best I can describe it, is a mathematical model of the Enigma machine. And this is where they got the information, you know, Turing took it and came up with a bomb. How they did it, I don't know. They didn't have computers back then. Must have taken a lot of paper and pencils. Now, here's the Colossus. This is the system that broke out the what they call the fish methods, the Hitler's high command communications. Now it's kind of nicknamed Hitler's BlackBerry. It was a teletype system. You can see they've got two teletype tape loops running. One is constantly running with the daily or that day's traffic on it. It's quite a system. It was breaking it out almost in real time, believe it or not. And there, There's more of it. The gentleman with the blue shirt, he wasn't just there to say, here's the Colossus. This guy was sharp. We threw a couple technical questions at him, and boy, did he answer. He was really terrific. This is the memorial recently dedicated by the Queen, as you heard in her speech. If you can break it out, it says on there, "We also served." There she is dedicating it. And this is our Navy group in front of the bomb. One of them is here today, right here, Fred. This is a collection of Enigma machines. They have about a dozen of them. This is an Enigma machine owned by Mick Jagger. It's on loan, sort of permanent loan to Bletchley, which I think is a terrific thing to do. Now, this is a statue of Alan Turing. I don't know if you've ever saw the play in New York a few years ago called Breaking the Code with Derek Jacobi. It was all about Alan Turing. He built the bomb. He ended the war, or the war was ended because of him, they figure a couple years early, and he was a genius. Probably IQ up there with Einstein. He's credited with building the first digital computer, or as he called it, a programmable logic device with a stored program. That sounds like a computer to me. He did all this, he built a computer. He's working at Manchester University after the war. And he was into every scientific area you can think of. He was also a runner. He'd been known to run from Bletchley to London, which was about 90 miles. I don't think he did it every day. But he had his problems also. He was gay. He was autistic. And he had some personality problems. And during that time, and after the war, it was illegal to be gay in the UK. If you're gay, you go to jail. Apparently, he let it slip, I think, to a cop that he was having an affair with some guy, and the cop arrested him. And I guess because of who he was, they tried to fix him with hormone shots and everything, but it didn't work. And shortly before he was to go to trial, he killed himself. And the way he killed himself was he took an apple, put some cyanide in it, took a bite out of the apple, and he was gone. Now, does that ring any bells with anyone? That little scenario there has affected the world. Probably everybody here, even if it's just an awareness of it. And before I tell you what it is, you may be aware there's a lot of controversy about this very subject. If you look it up on the internet, you're going to see all kinds of bullshit. And I believe what Bletchley Park told us, because I think now that everybody else is out of the picture, they are the authority on it. There's your apple. There's your colors. There's the bite taken out of it. Like I say, I believe what they told us of Bletchley. And I'll tell you, when they mentioned that, I said, huh? I never associated the two at all. So, now this is a little personal here as far as I'm concerned. This is Tony Sale. Tony is a retired GCHQ engineer, top of the line. He's the guy that rebuilt Colossus almost from scratch. He established the Bletchley Trust. He put Bletchley back on the map as a national treasure. A couple days before we went to Bletchley, I picked up one of the London newspapers, and there's, I think, that very picture with a full-page obit. He had just died, which was unfortunate because I didn't have a chance to meet him. Here he is showing the Colossus to the Queen. There's a great picture of him. There he is demonstrating it. And the reason I mention him and the fact that he passed away is when our Navy group got there, we were at the gate. I asked the gate fellow, where should we go? They expect us. He said, well, go to the mansion and look for Margaret. Yeah, okay, there's probably some gal named Margaret. Well, it was Margaret Sale, his wife, or widow, I guess you would call her. And she was there walking around with her walkie-talkie, barking orders, directing the place and everything. And in particular, she took such great care of us, the Navy guys. She had coffee, tea, and crumpets waiting for us when we got there. She had a lunch for us that was out of this world. She made a shepherd's pie. Fred and I were fighting over the leftovers. He's the only guy I know that can eat more than me. And then when we left, she had coffee, tea, and crumpets waiting for us. And considering her tremendous loss, you know, she's quite a lady. So my wife and I just dug down, took all the pounds we had with us and everything and donated to her right there. And she said, well, they're going to use that to paint one of the huts. So. September 2nd, month after next, they're doing it again. They're going to have That's when the next annual reunion is going to be at Bletchley. If anybody's going to be in the UK, if you can swing it, go. You will never forget it. My wife and I are going to be there. We've already got our reservations and everything. Last week, they ran the Olympic torch through Bletchley. They don't miss a thing. They do everything so well. And this is something they did not do because it was foggy and rainy, but they did the year before. And I think if they had done it while we were there, I would probably still have the goosebumps. They flew a Lancaster bomber over the place. Probably do it next month, weather permitting. You should ask the guy that was here before giving a talk if the weather's going to be permitting. Probably would have known. I don't know if you like watching airplanes. I do. But this was something. Shot coming over the museum. Yeah, here comes over the museum. Back for a little more Enigma variations, and just part of another speech you may have heard. Great pep talk.
We shall fight in France, we shall fight on the seas and oceans, we shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air, we shall defend our island. Whatever the cost may be, we shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island, or a large part of it, were subjugated and starving, then our empire, beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
Okay, so that's about it. If anybody has any comments or want to throw something at me, please do. But first, let me just throw one out here. We got any veterans here? Stand up.
Thank you.
By the way, these two guys up here were known as U.S. Navy cryptologic technicians. They were professional hackers, and they were just about the best there were. One fellow was in Iceland, Alaska, and Winter Harbor, Maine. This other guy here used to sit on Guam, hacking the whole Russian fleet. So if anybody has anything you want to throw, go ahead. Yeah, please. I think one had the traffic on it, the encrypted traffic, and the other had some form of the key.
That's going back one short generation. The reason they make the bus is so fast is actually one was stored in the machine. And the unencrypted traffic, the encrypted traffic was on a big tape.
That could be. And then they would do a XOR function between the two. And, yeah, they may have been able to store part of it in there, yeah, because they did have a load of tubes in there.
One of the things they did was actually, they went XORing across the key and the stored message because they didn't know what to fit that way. What they were actually doing was taking separations in time, so between byte one and byte two. And statistically, that's very significant. Because there were certain patterns that you could derive out of that, and those patterns are then a one-bit offset of distance.
That's cool. I didn't know that. Interesting.
Put this in context. I don't think any of us would be here without our story. He was the guy who started it all.
Yeah, when we built our bomb, we had a bomb which had one more rotor than the British bomb. Turing actually came over here to Dayton at National Cash Register where they built it. He was actually over here working on it.
On the island, and there were these two odd old buildings
Well, funny you should mention that, because in all the stuff that I've been brainwashed with in the Navy, we've heard a lot about, we broke the Purple Code and all that stuff, but I've never seen any equipment for it until last Christmas. I was at Pearl Harbor. And before you take the boat out to the Arizona, they have a museum there on shore. And I'm looking at this thing, and holy mackerel, here's this great big wooden box, and says, this is the Purple machine. And it looks like it has just a bunch of telephone relays in it, but that's the only thing I've ever seen on Purple. So it could have been done out there, although, actually, I don't know where they did it. I just presumed it was in the Washington area, but that makes sense because you're looking at the Pacific Fleet and what have you. Yeah, but we had people out in the Pacific also called the FRUPAC, which is Fleet Radio Unit Pacific. There was a bunch of guys out there all over the place copying the code, and they were actually decrypting the Japanese codes out there also. That could be. What? Oh, yeah, that's right. They did a lot in Hawaii also. I think that's why they had the Purple machine there. But that was the only time I'd ever seen one. You know, there's a lot of countries that even after the war were using the German Enigma machines. I think they started out in the banking business. Fred here is still, he did some hacking this morning that I couldn't believe. Fred's a head guy on a railroad. Bob and I were on a train coming down from Port Jervis this morning, and we get to the Otisville station, and it stopped. It quit. The engine gave out. And I was talking to Fred on my cell phone just as the conductor came walking down the aisle. It was a woman conductor, and she says, the train has stopped. We're not going anywhere. And he heard it. Yeah, he was laughing about it. And there was nothing we could do but just sit there and wait for the next train out of Port Jervis, which was about an hour and a half later. I guess that's inadvertent hacking. So thank you all for coming. Appreciate it.